This is 1A. I'm David Gura, in for Jen White. 2020 has been a year unlike any other. It's been full of challenges and change, and almost paradoxically, it's been a year that seemed to stand still. It began with a drone strike and catastrophic fires in Australia, then came the global pandemic. But 2020 was also a year of reckoning, of new economic hardship and political upheaval. So as we count down the hours till the clock strikes midnight, and as we hope for better things in 2021, we're going to take one last look back on a year many of us would be glad to forget. We're lucky to be joined in the 1A time machine by some very capable columnists and correspondents. Ed Luce is the U.S. National Editor at the Financial Times. Hey, Ed.
Great to be with you, David.
Eva McEnd covers Congress for Spectrum News. Eva, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
And Lauren Weber is the Midwest correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Lauren, appreciate your time on this last year, day of 2020.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to start with the impeachment of President Trump, and it does seem like a long time ago, given how each of these parts of the year seems like an epic ago. But when 2020 started, the impeachment inquiry was complete. House Democrats had drafted two articles. They were being sent to the Senate. And Eva, you have the unenviable task right now of sort of distilling these thousands of pages, the transcripts of that inquiry, up to the Senate. What did we learn from that inquiry?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to remember that this hugely consequential event happened this year, given all that we've been through as a country. But a president being impeached is no small act. As you mentioned, after months of House hearings, the House voted to impeach at the end of December. The trial took place in January. Essentially, the president was accused of soliciting foreign interference in the presidential election to help his own reelection bid by putting pressure on Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky to announce an investigation into his political opponent, Joe Biden, and to promote a conspiracy theory that was discredited, I might add, that Ukraine, not Russia, was actually behind the interference. Ultimately, President Trump was acquitted on those charges in the Republican-led Senate, those charges, abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. The one Republican to join Democrats and vote on that one article of abuse of power was Utah Senator Mitt Romney.
As Eva mentions, the president acquitted on those counts of abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. Let's listen to what he had to say shortly after that acquittal in the U.S. Senate.
It was evil. It was corrupt. It was dirty cops. It was leakers and liars. And this should never, ever happen to another president, ever. I don't know that other presidents would have been able to take it. Some people said no, they wouldn't have. But I can tell you, at a minimum, you have to focus on this because it can get away very quickly, no matter who you have with you. It can get away very quickly. It was a disgrace. Had I not fired James Comey, who was a disaster, by the way, it's possible I wouldn't even be standing here right now.
Ed Luce, as Eva said, this was no small thing. He became the third president in U.S. history to be impeached. And I wonder how you've thought of the legacy of that inquiry and that trial. It certainly provided some grievance gasoline that propelled him through the campaign to the election day. What's the legacy when you look at history more largely?
Well, I think the sort of natural, you mentioned two other presidents that had been through impeachment, Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton. Richard Nixon was going to be impeached, but he resigned before that. But the Nixon analogy and contrast is, I think, the most interesting if you stand back and try and look at this from an historical point of view. Because what happened after Nixon resigned was there was a great sort of period of reform in Congress, which was fairly bipartisan. You had Republicans and Democrats looking into what had gone wrong during the Nixon administration and trying to rein in presidential power. The Church Committee and other works of other congressional committees, you know, became justly famous for that. This impeachment really produced, I think, quite the opposite, which was, with the exception, as Eva mentioned, of Mitt Romney's single vote to convict Trump on abuse of power, no Republicans joined the effort. No Republicans accepted that there was anything remotely impeachable in Trump's conduct. And there is no post-Trump bipartisan horizon beckoning of reform of presidential power. So I think ultimately what we will see this this third American impeachment, presidential impeachment, as being about is a measure of how deeply polarized American politics has become.
Lauren Weber, coincident with this was the discovery of a virus in China, a sense of it spreading around the world as well. We remember back in mid-January, the president at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, sitting down with CNBC and declaring that things were going to be just fine. Help us remember what was happening at this time and how quickly world leaders got a grip on how bad this could be.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, a year ago today was the first notification to the world, so to speak, that in Wuhan, we had found some sort of pneumonia-like illness that was striking folks. They believed it was originating from a wet market. There was no talk of human-to-human transmission. It was thought that it was something that people had eaten. That was a year ago today. And now we're 80-plus million cases later, 1.8 million deaths around the world, and we have COVID-19. And so, as you said, you know, the president spoke in January about how this was supposed to go away. It wasn't anything that was large. Back in January, this was afflicting China, and it was very much thought of as a China problem. You know, you had the first real warning signs, I think, when everyone started to wake up is when Wuhan was shut down. That's a city of 11 million. That's larger than New York City. And I think that's really when people started to realize we have a huge problem on our hands. But even then, I think in the United States, there was a thought process that this illness that was spreading in China, you know, that's very far away. That's not something that could happen here. We have the best hospital healthcare system in the world. How could we possibly be affected by this mysterious illness? You know, these images and videos of people in hazmat suits just seemed very removed back in January for the American public.
That's Lauren Weber of Kaiser Health News. I'm also joined by Eva McCann, congressional correspondent for Spectrum News, and Ed Luce, columnist and national editor at the Financial Times. And Ed, you've written about and talked about sort of deterioration of relationships among countries, the portend of the end of globalization. And I wonder how you apply that to what we saw in those days after that virus was discovered in Wuhan. We saw the U.S. rejecting the World Health Organization, declaring that it was no longer going to support that organization. What does it say to you more broadly about the fracturing of the United States' relationship with other countries?
I think it was a real test case of the degree to which U.S.-China differences and animosities can derail global cooperation, and most sort of obviously in this case with the World Health Organization, which was kind of the piggy in the middle between, you know, a China that wanted the WHO to give it a certification of good conduct and a United States that wanted the WHO to blame China for what Trump, you know, took to calling the Wuhan virus or the China virus. And so you had the WHO not completely disabled, but deeply stymied by this U.S.-China antagonism. I think, though, that, you know, there were other countries, notably most of the European countries, that got together with countries around the world, Australia being a leading one, to create this COVAX alliance. To distribute a vaccine whenever it was going to be produced. That was formed quite early on in this pandemic. America stood apart from it. The Biden administration will join it. But the U.S.-China sort of differences are what predominated during the pandemic, and they look like being one of the sort of key casualties.
Eva McCann, remind us of what the United States was doing at this time. You know, early on in the year, we had the formation of the White House Coronavirus Task Force. I think in late February, the president named his vice president to chair that organization. In March, the U.S. declared a national emergency.
To unleash the full power of the federal government in this effort today, I am officially declaring a national emergency. Two very big words. The action I am taking will open up access to up to $50 billion of, very important and a large amount of money for states and territories and localities in our shared fight against this disease. In furtherance of the order, I'm urging every state to set up emergency operation centers effective immediately.
Eva, what did those early days tell us about how the Trump administration, the U.S. government, would handle this crisis in the months to come?
Yeah, I mean, it's clear from what we know now that President Trump always viewed COVID as a threat to his presidency. And early on, you know, he only made those remarks in March when he, or in early spring, when it was clear that he had no other choice. You know, there were at this point lockdowns in Italy, most dramatically. We saw the aggressive lockdowns there. And the U.S. had to respond. But, President Trump was speaking in two ways about this. He was saying that it was a national emergency, but at the same time saying, oh, this is no big deal and this is going to be over by Easter. So it was clear that we were going to get, and we continue to get a lot of that sort of same dual approach to this virus from him and some members of the administration in the weeks and months to come.
That's Eva McCann, congressional correspondent at Spectrum News. Lauren Weber is the Midwest correspondent at Kaiser Health News. And Ed Luce, columnist and U.S. national editor at the Financial Times. As we take stock of the year that was, we will remember what was a long, hot summer, and we'll track the spread of the coronavirus and also conspiracy theories. I'm David Gura. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR. I'm David Gura. This is 1A, and we're attempting to round up the major stories of the last year, which you'll appreciate is no small thing. We also want to hear from you. There was a relentlessness to the news over the last 365 days. What are the stories we should not forget? What are the lessons we should learn from them? You can comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or send us an email, 1A@WAMU.org. Something we've been watching throughout all of this has been the dynamic between the federal government and states. We saw this with stay-at-home orders, how states handled testing and mask mandates, and we're seeing it now with vaccine distribution. By April, nearly 40 states had issued stay-at-home orders, and hospitals were struggling to keep up with an onslaught of patients. Lauren Weber of Kaiser Health News, let me ask you to remind us what that was like. Where I live in New York, the sound of sirens was the kind of sober accompaniment to those days. The health systems became overwhelmed. What have we learned about what caused that, and what lessons do we take from that as we look ahead to what may be a dark couple of months?
Well, sadly, we learned a lot, but we continue to see the pattern repeated today, which is why it's important to kind of go back to those early days. I mean, as you noted, in New York City, the sirens were going nonstop. You were seeing hospitals slammed over and over and over again with a crush of patients. And in particular, and as you see around the country, you see hospitals usually slammed that are in more disadvantaged areas. You see patients of color affected more predominantly. You see folks that are unable to work from home being infected more. And these are the people that are swarming the hospitals over and over and over again. And, you know, beyond New York City, as this trickled out to the rest of the country and began to grow in size, you saw this happen not just in New York, but in California and then in Texas. It was like a slow-moving wave where, you know, once one state got things under control, another state was slammed. And amid all of this, you had huge competition for personal protective equipment. I think it's important to really note that at this time, there was a mad scramble, not only for ventilators, but for basic masks and gloves and things to keep our healthcare workers safe, who unfortunately really have also been victims of this pandemic due to improper, you know, protective equipment procurement. And you just kind of saw this take off across the country, and the disparate patchwork way that it was attacked in different states led to also a lot of confusion. You know, I live in Missouri. We had very different rules than you did in April of the pandemic. And that kind of patchwork differences has really played out across this year and led to a lot of confusion for many people.
Ed Luce of the Financial Times, about that confusion, around this time we saw the emergence of these insidious and invidious conspiracy theories, and health officials, including Dr. Anthony Fauci, tried to combat the spread of that kind of misinformation.
Trouble is, you go to different parts of the country, and even when the outbreak is clear and hospitals are on the verge of being overrun, there are a substantial proportion of the people who still think that this is not real, that it's fake news or that it's a hoax. It's extraordinary. I've never really seen anything like this. We've got to overcome that and pull together as a nation uniformly with adhering to these public health measures.
Ed Luce, you hear Dr. Fauci then saying we have to overcome it. Really, we just saw the germination then of what became really mainstreamed in a lot of ways. And this has become an incredible hurdle for public health professionals.
It has. I mean, the first rule of any epidemic, as scientists will tell you, is to have clear and consistent public communication about the scientific guidelines. And that was singularly lacking. So, you know, you're always going to have QAnon-style conspiracy theories about any public event on the internet and a certain proportion of the people believing it. But when you have the President of the United States, as Donald Trump was, fronting these coronavirus briefings, press briefings, every day for a period of weeks, and bringing up all kinds of different theories, including that China had deliberately sort of manufactured this as a biological weapon, which was one thing that was pushed for a while, that masks were actually dangerous because they contained microbes, something that, you know, the medical profession has known for at least a century is not true, otherwise they wouldn't wear them, that hospitals were exaggerating their COVID infection and mortality rates in order to get more money. I mean, there were a sort of whole host of conspiracies that were either directly voiced by the president or retweeted or at least in some way endorsed. So Dr. Fauci and Deborah Birx and others, you know, had their hands full attempting to combat this. And it's true to say, I think, that even today, on the eve of 2021, with 1 year into the beginning of this virus, those conspiracy theories are as rampant as ever.
And Aoife McKen, they were rampant in the halls of Congress that you cover day in and day out for Spectrum News. That was something to behold, hearing lawmakers repeating and spouting these conspiracy theories over the course of this.
Yeah, I mean, the fight over what the impact of the virus really was a proxy fight for other arguments that Congress has, right? Some of the responses of Democratic leadership to lean aggressively into these lockdowns to stop the spread of the virus was a proxy fight for this larger conversation about socialism. I think if it were up to a lot of Democratic leadership, a lot more aid would have been given to people to just stay home. We are one of the only developed countries in the world that didn't just pay people to stay home and have really aggressive aid go out to people suffering from the virus. And so this idea that, some congressional Republicans referred to Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear, a Democrat, as a dictator. These conversations were happening in Congress, but really they illustrated, I think, a larger philosophical difference in how to deal with these type of issues and what the role of government should be when we are confronting this type of crisis.
Lauren Weber, help us understand what it meant for practitioners themselves. I was on the phone with a friend of mine who's an ER doctor in Western North Carolina, and she said, you don't understand what it's like to have a patient come in. The protocol for the hospital is to test everyone who comes in, regardless of whether he or she is exhibiting symptoms. And the number of accusations she and her colleagues face on a daily basis of, you're doing this to get case counts up. I mean, this had real ramifications, continues to have real ramifications for those who are on the front lines.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, imagine you're an ER doctor, you're risking your life every day to save the patients that come to you. And some of them don't believe in COVID. They don't believe in wearing a mask. They don't believe in being tested. They think you're out to get you. And I mean, we saw this also reflected in the public health profession. You know, around this time in the spring, summer, I had started to note, along with some of my AP colleagues, that public health officials were being harassed at rates we had not seen. They were being vilified on social media. Some of them were being driven from their jobs. They had armed protesters showing up at their homes. You know, the most notable case around this time was Amy Acton in Ohio. And we only saw that continue to grow, this vilification of public health officials trying, you know, to put in quarantine measures or lockdowns or there are things that had terrible economic effects, but were put in place to help slow the spread, ended up becoming public punching bags for people who disagreed with their rhetoric or their motives or what they were doing. And it's led a record number of them to retire, resign, or be fired. There's 181 public health leaders in this country that have left since the beginning of the pandemic, an untold high number. And, you know, at the time we need these people the most, they're being run out of office.
Ed Luce, yoked together is the epidemiological crisis and the economic crisis that was born from this. And I know you were paying attention to what was going on in the Eccles Building here in Washington, D.C., in tandem with what was happening on Capitol Hill. We saw a great movement in monetary policy here in the United States to attempt to lessen the blow from this economic crisis. There was palpable frustration from the Fed chairman that Congress wasn't doing as much, even if he wouldn't have said so explicitly. Remind us of how deep a dive the economy took in the early months of this year.
This was the deepest, the steepest fall in economic production since the 1930s. It was unprecedented, but of course very different to previous kinds of falls in that it was deliberate. It was engineered because we needed the economy to be locked down. And so it dropped more than 40% in the second quarter, rebounded 30-something percent in Q3 as a lot of the lockdown restrictions were lifted. As you point out, Jay Powell, the chairman of the Fed, was very, very upfront, I mean, unusually so by the standards of a Fed chair, in asking Congress to do its part fiscally. And to some degree, in late March, early April, with the CARES Act, the $2.3 trillion pandemic relief bill, to some degree got what he wanted, but it wasn't then followed up until last week with the $900 billion bill. And the U.S. system really was an outlier compared to most developed economies in only having these ad hoc assistance bills for essential workers and others, rather than guaranteed support that you've seen in Western Europe and you've seen in Canada. So that debate continues. It looks like we're probably going to be heading back into more negative growth because of the pandemic situation, because of the worsening pandemic situation in the first quarter of 2021.
Eva McCann, pick it up from there, if you would. Again, you cover Congress and you've seen how this has played out there. We have now what seems systematized, which is a race to deadline after deadline in Congress. Months passed after the expiration of a number of those benefits, and Congress did nothing in that period of time. There was some debate, but no action. You must have marveled at that, given the seriousness of what you could see outside the Capitol.
Yeah, I mean, it's been really devastating. But again, this crisis has shown that Republicans and Democrats feel very differently about the type of investments we should make when we have this type of crisis. We saw that in full display with these $2,000 payments, which to someone who finds themselves homeless and jobless in the middle of this pandemic, which I've spoken to people in Kentucky who are facing that reality, $2,000 would just be a drop in the bucket. And yet that can't pass given the dynamics of what we're dealing with in Congress. So I expect these types of fights to continue to play out in 2021, just because Republicans and Democrats feel so differently about what their role should be in assisting Americans, or what the government's role should be in assisting Americans.
I'm David Gura, and you're listening to 1A. We're rounding up the year with Ed Luce, columnist and U.S. national editor at the Financial Times, Eva McCann, who covers Congress for Spectrum News, and Lauren Weber, who is Kaiser Health News' Midwestern correspondent. On May 25th, police killed George Floyd in Minneapolis, and his death sparked protests across the country.
No peace! No justice! No peace!
Eva McCann, I'll turn to you first, just to put this into some context for us. There were those protests in Minneapolis. We saw protests across the country and indeed around the world after that. What was so catalytic about this killing?
Well, I think it was one after another in the spring. And then also we had this dynamic of people at home being able to digest these images in a way that maybe they weren't before. The pandemic forcing so many of us to stay home and seeing these images one after the other. You mentioned George Floyd. I want to lift up the name of Breonna Taylor, mm-hmm. a 26-year-old black woman fatally shot in her Louisville apartment on March 13th during a drug investigation. That actually did not really gain national attention until her family and friends posted on social media later in the spring about May, and then it became a source of international outcry. People asking, why does a drug investigation have to lead to a death sentence for this young black woman? And I think that it resonated with so many people and these episodes, not only because they came one after the other, but because we were all watching them together and processing what was happening as a nation. We had no other choice but to sit and watch and stay still and look at these images and understand sort of that this conversation about white supremacy, about disproportionate policing in communities of color, about the criminal justice system disproportionate sentencing for folks of color, all of that now was coming into focus.
Ed Luce, I want you to weigh in on this as well, talking about George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery as well, just about how seismic this was for American culture over the course of the summer.
I think it was extraordinarily seismic. I mean, just look at it from the global perspective. It wasn't just that you had demonstrations all around the United States in small towns, you know, in Hawaii, all over the place, which was really unusual. Some, you know, majority white demonstrations. It was that you had the same happening, you know, from Antwerp to Adelaide, across the world. So it was sort of comparable, I don't know, with maybe the assassination of Martin Luther King in highlighting the continuation of racial injustice in the United States on a global level. So I think that's sort of one important, hugely important aspect of this. Another is, you know, that it did shape the contours of the general election. The fact that Joe Biden very quickly distanced himself from the defund the police element of some of these protests and was very quick to condemn any looting or out of hand demonstrations that did occur didn't seem to benefit his party as a whole. This was something that Donald Trump, in all through the summer and at his convention in late August, tried to nail on the Democrats, that you are lawless, you are Antifa, you are looters. The president even quoted George Wallace, the famous segregationist, that when the looting starts, the shooting starts. So the polarization that occurred and how that shaped the general election was, I think, another element of that. But to me, the standout sort of fact of this is just how aware the world was at this moment of what goes on in America. And I'll mention one other thing.
Sure, quickly.
Which is the Chinese Foreign Ministry saw a tweet from the US State Department about human rights violations in Hong Kong. The response was, "I can't breathe."
Ed Luce, columnist, U.S. National Editor at the Financial Times, is with me along with Eva McCann, Congressional Correspondent at Spectrum News, Lauren Weber, Midwestern Correspondent at Kaiser Health News. I'm David Gura. We're going to hear much more from you and our guests in a moment here on 1A. Rounding up the year in news, and we heard from some of you about the stories you thought that did not receive enough attention this year. Here's voicemail from one listener.
I feel like stories and updates about climate change and the climate emergency were definitely overshadowed by other news, often for very good reason. But I will say that one silver lining to this, to the coverage, especially about racial injustice and about the deterioration of our democracy, I think that coverage of those stories has helped to highlight the fact that climate justice is inextricably linked to all of these social justice issues.
Grateful for that call. We did want to mention a couple climate stories from 2020. At the beginning of the year, rising temperatures and a severe drought brought devastating fires to Australia. They blanketed the country, killing hundreds of people, thousands of animals. In March, scientists found that climate change contributed to the abnormally severe bushfires. This year also marked California's worst wildfire season on record. 31 people died. Over 4 million acres of land were burned in those fires. And scientists have attributed those fires to climate change as well. I want to jump back into our conversation with Ed Luce of the Financial Times, Eva McKend of Spectrum News, and Lauren Weber of Kaiser Health News. We talked about what led to a summer of protests. Another story that emerged from that was how police interacted with those protesters. And Eva, let me start with you. There were some really brutal images of police clashing with protesters during that time. As Ed Luce mentioned just a moment ago, this became a thread of the presidential campaign. What was happening then, and how powerful were those images?
Yeah, it almost seemed tone deaf, right? People are taking to the streets to organize against police brutality, and yet we're getting these images at these very protests of excessive use of force. And then, of course, President Trump threw gasoline on the fire here with his own, with his big photo op moment on June 1st amid the protests in Washington, D.C., here in the nation's capital. Law enforcement officers used tear gas and other sort of riot tactics to clear out peaceful protesters from Lafayette Square, creating a path for President Trump and other officials to walk to the St. John's Episcopal Church, which had a small fire, I believe, the night before during the demonstrations. And the aggression, I think, that we saw from some officers during these protests really came from the top. It was important for President Trump to sort of have this very performative act of strength, and I don't know if it really met the moment that we were in. Military officials, of course, who participated in that photo op later said that they regretted it, and the entire episode was widely condemned as an excessive use of force.
Ed Luce, it's such an indelible image, the one that Eva just described there, the president making his way on foot from the White House to that church and holding up that upside-down Bible for that photo opportunity. And I think of so many moments during the course of the last year when the president has tried to insert himself into any number of these stories. I would be curious to hear just sort of what you think the longevity of that moment is, sort of what you made of it when you saw that play out in real time.
Fearful and breathtaking. I mean, it, as the image of the year, I think it probably is top, perhaps the one of the president sort of coming out of Walter Reed for his drive around when he was in there for COVID-19 might compete. But this was extraordinary. Most of all, because, you know, he had the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, in uniform with him. Now, General Milley has subsequently rode back from that and made it very clear that his loyalty is to the Constitution and not personally to the president. But to have the Attorney General, the senior brass, with the president walking across to a church that he had never attended, holding a Bible upside down, to demonstrate somehow that his having violently cleared these demonstrators, to demonstrate somehow that he was the symbol of goodness and morality amidst a sort of sea of anarchy, was, I think, such a dystopian image and so at odds with what the reality was that it can't fail to stick as a darkly iconic moment in what has been a darkly iconic year.
Mm. Another pivotal moment we want to mark is the passing of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She died in September at the age of 87 after a life fighting for gender equality and equal justice under the law. President Trump and congressional Republicans rushed to confirm Judge Amy Coney Barrett. That happened only 8 days before the election. I should say, in defiance of the late justice's wishes, she wanted her successor to be named after the presidential election. And now the Supreme Court has a solid conservative majority. Turning back to COVID here, Lauren Weber, as the weather started to cool down, we saw another wave of cases begin to crest. And I'm not the only one, I'm sure, who remembers the op-ed that the vice president, also the chair of the coronavirus task force, wrote in the Wall Street Journal, kind of spitting in the media's eye, saying there is no second wave here. That wave has crested, and worse has come yet. What have we learned about the progression of this virus and also about the way that it's affected different groups, different kinds of Americans?
Well, first, I mean, most importantly, we've learned that even if we're tired of COVID-19, COVID-19 is not tired of us. It does not care. If you have pandemic fatigue, it will still come for you. And secondly, as you pointed out, how it affects different demographics differently. You know, back in the summer, the New York Times actually sued the CDC and obtained data that showed Latino and African American U.S. residents have been three times as likely to become infected as their white counterparts. And they've been nearly twice as likely to die. This is back in July from that data. And, you know, there's a lot of conversation, especially as these protests were going on, too, about the disproportionate impact of COVID-19 on these populations. And a lot of it has to do with, and this is a public health jargony word that became a bit of a buzzy one in 2020, but the social determinants of health, uh-huh. which are all these factors that are outside of yourself. They're environmental, they're socioeconomic, they're where you live, they're how much money you make, they're, you know, what's going on in the environment around you. Can you work from home or are you on the bus every day? What does that look like for you? And we saw in stark terms that some of the consequences of that are people are no longer at their kitchen tables at rates that are much higher for these minority populations.
And Lauren, you know, as we talk about images that stick in our minds over the course of this year, we've looked at pictures of how the pandemic has played out in other countries. Probably feel a sense of some sorrow as you see kids going back to school in some places, a level of normalcy returns in some of these other countries. What have we learned about how other governments, other countries have tackled this virus and the successes they've had?
I mean, I think we've learned that the patchwork system that we've seen implemented in the U.S. is not sufficient. You need a strong federal response. And I mean, Ed touched on this earlier, but you need strong national communication from the get-go. You know, by having this patchwork state response where some states had mask mandates, some states didn't, you sow seeds of doubt and disinformation spread so much more readily. And, you know, our testing apparatus wasn't nearly as successful as some of these other, you know, countries that were able from the get-go, coordinated at a federal level to implement strategy. And you just never really saw that federal strategy take hold in the U.S. You saw this patchwork attempt to replace it, and it's proved fatal for some people.
Eva, when historians look back on the primary campaign, there were 28 candidates for the Democratic nomination. That was winnowed down to the former vice president, now president-elect Joe Biden. What will they learn from the way that primary was waged? Yes, it was under difficult and strange circumstances because of the pandemic that was going on simultaneously. But what of how it resolved itself?
Well, I think that people will remember not to underestimate the power of Black voters and their significance in the Democratic Party. You know, it looked like maybe Senator Bernie Sanders was going to emerge as victorious, but Black voters in South Carolina were pivotal. They had something to say. Congressman James Clyburn's endorsement was hugely consequential in elevating Joe Biden. And then Joe Biden was successful on Super Tuesday, where he won 10 states. And so I think that will be the story when we look back on the primary, right? Because it ended pretty soon after that with the virus. It forced everyone to be home. We didn't have the massive campaign rallies that we're used to seeing and all of that energy. And so the most significant time of the primary was really the early days, the early weeks and months. And Black voters in the South really played a determinative role in how everything ultimately shaked out.
And as we move to the general election, we did have some debates. There were some changes made there. The erosion of norms continues. Let's take a listen to that first debate between Donald Trump and Joe Biden.
I'm not going to answer the question.
Why
because,
would you answer that
because
question?
Because the
you
question
want to put a
is,
lot of
the
new
question
Supreme
is,
Court justice, the radical
question,
left.
Will you shut
who is
up,
on,
man.
Listen, who is on your list, Joe?
This
Who's
is
on
so
your list?
Right. Gentlemen,
is,
I think
this
we've
is
ended
so
this.
He's going to pack the court.
We have
end, we're
no,
not
no.
going to give a list.
We have ended this segment. We're going to move on to the second segment.
Eva McKen, that exchange and that debate as a whole says so much about the state of the quality of our politics in this country today.
Yeah, I was speaking to a psychologist at Swarthmore College who studies polarization, and he told me that he's never seen anything like this. And so we'll have to see in the post-Trump era if this polarization follows us into 2021. But that clip that you just played was a really good way to characterize or illustrate what we're dealing with as a nation, where people can't even speak to one another in civil terms or in a civil way about the crises that we face.
I'm David Gura. You're listening to 1A. We're looking back on 2020 with Ed Luce, columnist and U.S. national editor at the Financial Times, Eva McKen, congressional correspondent at Spectrum News, getting a good shout out there for her alma mater, Swarthmore College, and Lauren Weber, Midwestern correspondent at Kaiser Health News. And Ed, we can't cleave this pandemic from the campaign or the election itself. We've touched on this a little bit, how it changed the way these candidates campaigned, how they chose to campaign, certainly changed how people voted in the general election as well. Just the unprecedented number of ballots that were cast by mail as people were rightly fearful of going out in person in crowds to cast their votes on election day. Do you look at this as an anomalous year, or has it changed the way that electoral politics is going to be conducted in this country going forward?
That's a good question, and I think it's an open question. A lot depends on whether the 40% of the country or so that believes this is a stolen election that takes Trump's cue on this sort of betrayal narrative continues to believe that. And of course, whether they do or don't depends to some degree on whether Trump decides to stay on in politics. Will he be a candidate in 2024, or will he at least want to keep people guessing by not declaring either way? I think one of the great strengths of the American electoral system is that it is a state-based system, and that, you know, it would be very hard to hack because it is so localized. But that is also a great weakness in that it's very hard to federally reform this system, to streamline it and to homogenize it, to make voting processes consistent between states, between counties, between cities. I do think, though, that the sort of deeper polarization that, you know, Trump personifies is going to continue. You cannot have a sort of normal functioning democracy when almost half its people believe that an election, without evidence, that election has simply been stolen. That's a sort of red flashing light.
And Ed, as you talk about politics personified, I wonder if you're of the camp that thinks the Republican Party is now Trump personified as well, as we look at the remarks from the junior senator from Missouri, from Josh Hawley, saying he's not going to vote in favor of certifying those Electoral College results on January the 6th. Things have changed radically over the course of these last 4 years, certainly, and definitely in this last year as well.
Yes, I think it's Trump's party. You know, I think if you ask Larry Hogan, the governor of Maryland, or even nowadays Chris Christie, former New Jersey governor,
Republicans both,
but Republicans both, they might, you know, disagree or you know, have a different emphasis. Mitt Romney might disagree, but sort of the vast bulk of people hoping to inherit Trump's mantle are talking in ultra Trumpian terms, and Josh Hawley's sort of put down a really egregious sort of early marker of his 2024 ambitions with what is an extravagant Trumpian gesture.
Lauren Weber, a bit of good news here in the remaining minutes we have, and that is the deployment of vaccines to fight COVID-19. This was something that the president had promised, wished would happen. Indeed, it has. We're seeing these vaccines having been approved and now deployed. Were you surprised by that, by how quickly this happened? What does it say about the regulatory apparatus that, that was in place and indeed was changed over the course of the last year?
I mean, look, it's a scientific marvel that we're going to have tools to actually be back this pandemic and that we're already getting shots into people's arms. You know, as we look forward in the year to come, I think the question is now how fast are we going to see those shots deployed? And, you know, so far you've seen about 14 million doses sent out to states around the country, but really only 2 million have been administered. So you have this push-pull of how fast you can get this out and also how safely you can get the into people's arms, considering, you know, the frozen requirements and everything else logistically that goes into administering this novel new vaccine.
And Lauren, in the department of cart before the horse, I mean, is there a playbook here, or to what extent are states now trying to figure this out in real time because there was no playbook for the deployment of these vaccines?
So, I mean, like most of the things in the COVID-19 pandemic, there was no deployment. There was no playbook for the deployment. Yeah. And also states have been once again left on their own to figure it out. And I think that's why you see that lag of 14 million doses sent out, but only 2 million delivered. And it's a problem. Once again, it's a lack of a coordinated federal response. You know, these states have kind of been given these shipments of vaccine and said, figure it out. And here's the deal. Public health systems, as I discussed earlier in the hour, have been completely overwhelmed. I mean, these folks are barely able to keep up with contact tracing. Mm. Now you've added on a national vaccine campaign, which just doesn't, you know, it includes more than just vaccinating people. It also includes fighting disinformation.
Sure.
And so we have an uphill battle to make sure that that happens over the next couple months.
Lauren Weber with Kaiser Health News. My thanks to Ed Luce as well. He's with the Financial Times, and Eva McCann, who covers Congress for Spectrum News, all of whom did yeoman's work today, helping us review what was an incredibly busy, dare I say, exhausting 12 months. Thanks to all of you. Happy New Year. Remember, 1A has a text club. We'll send you one text a day. It's the fastest way to connect with us. Details about how to sign up can be found in the Ask 1A tab at 1A.org. Today's producer is Michelle Harvin. The program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. So fly, feel I'm better on